You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and you can hear Book Lovers Cafe on Wednesdays at 5 after calendar and Sunday at 12:30. If you miss part, you can always go online and listen to our podcast page. Today, I'm really pleased to be talking to Melissa Phoebos. She's the author of the memoir Whip Smart from 2010, followed by a memoir essay collection called Abandon Me that was published in 2017. She is also the featured guest presenter at the 2018 Centrum Writers Conference right here in Port Townsend. She's an assistant professor of creative writing at Monmouth University, and she lives in Brooklyn. Today, she's talking to us from Provincetown on Cape Cod, and so there's a certain synchronicity to this conversation today. Welcome, Melissa. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
You know, I read a lot of reviews of Abandon Me, and it's called... Well, all your work is brutally honest, visceral, yet lyrical and beautiful. So I'd like you to start today by just reading a short segment from a little ways into the book that I think captures some of these words about your writing. So why don't you introduce it and just go ahead.
Sure. And thanks again. I've really been honored by the critical praise that the book has gotten. So I'm just going to read a few pages at the end of one of the earlier essays in the book, and it's called Call My Name. And it discusses my lifelong, somewhat fraught relationship to my own name. And these are the concluding pages. My mother kept bees when I was a girl. They lived in a white wooden hive behind her garden that resembled a chest of drawers, a small buzzing bureau. From the kitchen window, I could just make out the black specks of them, moving in and out, sometimes crawling on the face of it. When she harvested, I stood in the yard and watched her careful movements. She wore head-to-toe white and a veiled hat, Victorian, astronautical, a bride of bees with a smoking can in her glove instead of flowers. Her hand on the bellows, smoke streamed from the spout, a potion to slow the bees as she plundered their hive. She lifted the frames so carefully, the ready combs heavy with honey and capped with wax. The bees' song swelled across the yard as they rested on her white arms and clung to the netting over her face. With a nice stroke, she uncapped the comb and revealed each oozing hexagonal hole. Sometimes she handed me a broken comb, and I held that warm hunk, its sweetness dripping down my forearm as I fought not to crush it, ached to close my hand around its torn geometry and feel its honey cover my knuckles. Melissa fed the infant Zeus honey. That mountain nymph's bees delivered it straight into his mouth. This is the most common story, though there are many, and I have looked for myself in all of them. The bee nymph was known for introducing sweetness to men in the form of honey and thus taming them from eating one another, a civilizing influence. My mother didn't feed me sugar until I was nearly 4 years old. Honey was the only sweet my mouth knew, and her undressed cakes more manna than any frosted future ones. She tried. Honey might have tamed a different daughter. Sugar's grit might have better soothed my wild. I suspect I would have eaten myself alive either way. In other versions, Melissa hides the sticky-lipped baby to prevent him from being eaten by his father, Cronus. Find me a history without a monstrous father. Find me my father, there, in the shallow of our pond, dragging a metal rake, water darkening his cuffed pants. He's at it again, said my mother, shaking her head. He raked that muck all day, tried to beat it back and clear a path. But our pond was algae and animal. Its murky depths could not be cleared. It is a waste of time, my mother said, when there is so much to be done. Overnight, the path disappeared. Again, he raked. My mother left him. Still, he kept raking. He did not crush gold cans of Presidente like his father had. He did not collapse the drywall with our bodies. But I saw him weep in the yard. One hand on the fence, he folded over. "You are so lucky," he would say to me. I lay in bed and tried to make a prayer of it. "I am so lucky. I am so lucky." Through the wall, I heard him scream in his sleep. In this story, I was not the hider, but the hidden. My captain is no monster. He tried to save me from those other devourers, but it was impossible. Even when we write our own stories, there's no place to hide. The sound of my name still shocks me, Melissa, and I startle, as if the sayer has called out to and seen some hidden part of me. It strikes me as both stranger and skeleton key, part cuss, part promise, part secret, Melissa, and I open sesame. When lovers call my name in the bathtub, in bed, over the telephone, or into my ear, it closes my eyes, buckles me, thralls my insides with the sweet terror of being recognized. Sometimes we cannot bear the thing we crave. This is not a story about learning to love myself. My name is not a symbol. It is coded with all of this, the unseen, the near known, the rather not known. It hurts to hear everything my name holds, but I choose to drink from that river now, to carry that tangled history. I no longer want to change my name. I never did, really. I only wanted to know where I ended and everything else began, and I still do in these oceanic days. Like Franny Glass, I have begged of myself a prayer, begged of my name an answer, made them the same powerful thing. Aren't they both gestures of surrender? Melissa may not be another word for mercy, but every name is a name for God.
Them that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
You are listening to KPTZ, and that was the voice of Melissa Phoebos. She's the author of the memoir, Abandon Me, and that piece has so many layers once you discover what's within the pages of this book. Melissa has, the New Yorker has called Melissa's work mesmerizing. She's been interviewed by Terry Gross and Anderson Cooper on CNN. She's the daughter of a sea captain and a psychotherapist raised on Cape Cod. So you should feel right at home when you come to Port Townsend. Psychotherapy and the sea.
It's true, I do.
So have you been here before?
I have. I've been there many times before. I've taught at the conference before, but my father, the sea captain, actually lives in Port Townsend, and so I've been coming there for many years, every year, often twice a year, and it really feels like sort of a sister home to where I grew up on the Cape, and especially Provincetown, where mm-hmm. I'm sort of vacationing, having a little work vacation right now, because it's so similar. It's in almost the exact sort of symmetrical placement in the country, but it's also so different in terms of the geography and just, you know, everything here feels sort of close.
It does.
And fierce. And out there, it feels so capacious and big. It really takes my breath away. Mm-hmm. I love it there.
Well, you did mention some clues in the book, and mm-hmm. you know, because mm-hmm. I knew you were out at La Push. And let's talk about more about you and your writing. What were you like as a young teenager? Did you write? What did you read? What were your touchstones?
Mm-hmm. I was always a huge reader and writer. I really was obsessed with books from well before I was a teenager, when I was still a small child. I was an obsessive reader, and I was always scribbling little stories and carting around notebooks with me and forcing recitation audienceship on my family. And when I was really small, I actually made my bedroom into a library.
Mm-hmm.
And I stapled little cards into the backs of all my books and then made my family members borrow them from me.
You talk about a lot of literary touchstones, such as The Velveteen mm-hmm. Rabbit and Franny and Zooey. And
mm-hmm.
And also your secrets when you were young.
Mm-hmm.
You were a secretive
child. Yeah, I was a secretive child. And I think... I don't know. I wonder, I'm going to pose this hypothesis. I don't know if it's actually true,
mm-hmm.
but it might be true that a lot of people who are obsessed with reading at a very young age, I wouldn't be surprised if they also tended to be secretive. Because for me, I think that that early obsession with reading was very much about wanting to sort of disappear into another world and sort of the magic of sort of stepping through the looking glass of an author's creation into some fantasy or some alternate reality. And in many ways, I think sort of the urge to keep secrets, although it has kind of this like nefarious connotation, is really more innocent than that, especially in children. And it has to do with sort of seeking a feeling of being in control over something, you know, because no one really cares about the secrets that children keep, not the kind that I was keeping anyway. What I got from it.
One of your themes, and of course the title of the book, Abandonment, both mm-hmm. affected the fact that your father left for long periods of time, seemed mm-hmm. to, you know, kind of stoke up this fear of abandonment. And so the refuge mm-hmm. in reading, and then later you mention mm-hmm. as an adult, refuge in lists. I went, yes, make lists. That's always helpful. Let's talk about some of these themes, like abandonment. A lot of kids have traveling parents, but mm-hmm. it seemed to really impact you guys.
It did impact us. And, you know, it's interesting. I have, you know, I've written a lot about sort of the ordinary traumas of being human. And it feels important for me to say that I had a happy childhood, insofar as people have happy childhoods. You know, I was very loved. I wasn't abused in any way. We had a very close sort of loving family. But, I mean, one of the unavoidable facts of being human is that we have so little control over anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that everything is transient and temporary, and no one is infallible. And we're forced to confront the very uncomfortable fact that our parents and the people who take care of us are human, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I've done a lot. My first book was very much about sort of desire and secrecy and sort of, you know, how I am a person who has sort of worked out my issues in ways that seem sort of dramatic or sensational from the outside, but I have actually not experienced any extraordinary or profound traumas in the context of what people suffer, but that it is just painful in a very foundational way to be separated from the people you love, to discover that they are fallible, you know? And I think part of what I'm trying to do in my work is create space for people to honor the pain of those discoveries and experiences, even if it doesn't mean that anyone is at fault. Does that make sense?
Yes. And that's one thing I really noticed in your book, is that even though you go through a lot of dark experiences or psychological mm-hmm. trauma, you're not blaming anybody. You don't ever blame
mm-hmm.
anybody. And you know, I really noted that. So you've come out the other side as a successful writer and a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I really enjoyed in the book is your use of mythology. And you, mm-hmm. you know, you did that by discussing your name, the beautiful line that Melissa is makes the sound of ribbon on a scissors, mm-hmm. the curling ribbon. Oh, that was just great. I love that.
Thank you.
But tell us a little bit about, what parts of mythology you used, and maybe you could even go into the importance of watching the movie Labyrinth with your mm-hmm. with your brother.
Right. Well, you know, I think in many ways this book is about, it just goes all the way back for me. And it's really, one way of summing it up would be to say that it is about how the most powerful and formative experiences and early attachments and relationships of my childhood really informed the choices that I made as an adult, especially during a particular period, and it weaves together the past and present. And so, just for me as an individual, it was a very sort of archetypal book, right? It was going mm-hmm. back as far as I could in my own life and memory to sort of see what narratives I was drawing from to make sense of my experience and how I had sort of carried those narratives through my life into my adult life and into my adult decision-making. And so for me, the way that these other texts, and there's a lot of other texts, you mentioned the movie Labyrinth. I also talk about The Neverending Story and, mm-hmm. Pippi Longstocking, The Chronicles of Narnia. So there's sort of my own personal mythological texts. And then there's also a lot of Greek mythology and other kinds of literature and psychology that come into it. And that process of sort of braiding in other sources and the way that they sort of worked their way into the book and even became the subject matter in some cases was a very organic process. I didn't mm-hmm. set out to write a book that was doing that, but I think it made sense, and it makes sense in hindsight because I was looking at these very foundational sort of archetypal experiences of my own, and Greek mythology is the most archetypal, arguably, I guess, mm-hmm. but those are stories that we find again and again and again, and they recur all the way throughout since their inception until now,
We were living, you were living your own odyssey. Maybe mm-hmm, you were Circe, mm-hmm. maybe you were Calliope too. I love that part in the book. I love those interwoven parts about mythology.
And I think one of the arguments of the book really ended up being that part of why these stories have persisted for so long is because we can identify with more than one character, right? Like sometimes we're Odysseus, sometimes we're Penelope, sometimes we're the Velveteen Rabbit, sometimes we're the Velveteen Rabbit's child, you know? And that they represent these very sort of primary emotional experiences and fears about sort of journeying and coming home and finding oneself in betrayal and recovering from betrayal. And so, those experiences are never exhausted by humanity. Like, we always are having them, and I suspect we'll always keep having them. And so stories that feature and name and acknowledge and create a way of understanding those experiences and how to survive them, we'll always need them, And so in many ways, Abandoned Me is about how much I needed stories. And I think my hope for it is that it becomes a story like that, that other people who can identify with the basic intense feelings of it can sort of go to and see the potential for making sense mm-hmm. of those feelings and their being useful.
You're listening to KPTZ 91.9. We're talking to Melissa Phoebos on Book Lovers Cafe, and I'm Chris Wilson. She's the author of the memoirs Abandon Me and Whip Smart. So, Melissa, the structure of this book, how did it come to be? It's different. You've said it's different. You kind of move from a person that has an instinct for secrecy to one that has an instinct for confession. I think I mm-hmm. read that somewhere about you. Mm-hmm. Talk about mm-hmm. how the book came to be.
Right. I think I actually wrote that about myself, that I went from being a person who had an instinct for secrecy to someone who had an instinct for confession. And it seems like there's really sort of two questions here. And one of them is sort of how the form of me changed from someone who concealed things to someone who revealed things. And the other is really about sort of the structure of the book, which is strange. And so I'll sort of talk about those briefly separately. And the first part of it, I think, you know, for me, the instincts for secrecy and for confession are really sort of bound, you know, like nothing makes you want to reveal yourself like keeping a secret. And I think you always sort of simultaneously want to protect that hidden part, but you also really want to be seen. I think we all have a desire to be seen and known. And that's, for me, the most outstanding characteristic of so many kinds of love are just being seen and known. And so I think for me, being a secretive person, you know, and this is related to sort of things I've written about before, like my experience with addiction, sort of keeping those troubling parts of myself secret was incredibly isolating, and really alienated me from the people I loved most and from the help that I needed in many ways. And so I had some very basic, incredibly powerful experiences of revealing parts of myself and being able to access resources and help and the love of other people that helped me survive those experiences. And I think that, you know, from the very beginning, writing was a place for me to speak the things that I couldn't actually say out loud. I was always writing in journals and writing little stories. And I think in the very beginning, when I started publishing my work, the stakes felt so high, you know, and even publishing my first book was terrifying.
I mean, for me and
anyone who knew me, I think probably, but it was overwhelmingly such a positive experience. And I really heard from so many people who were moved by it. And even more importantly, I think helped by it, because the nature of secrecy is that we don't find other people who share those secret parts because we're all hiding them, right? And so this possibility that we might be the only person who has that particular burden remains alive because we don't share it. And so I think art and books and people who sort of expose those often stigmatized parts of being human that are often very common, that's part of why it's so powerful, is that other people who are keeping the same secrets get to see them and understand that they're not alone, you mm-hmm. know? And the book, my first book, definitely performed that for a lot of people, and it was so encouraging. And even though it was often awkward and embarrassing and hard to publish such a personal book, there was no doubt in my mind at all that it had been worth it, you know? And so that was a powerful reference, and that's just been compounded with really everything I've ever published. I've had that kind of experience. And also personally, I felt very liberated from the things that I was writing about by speaking them aloud and finding other people who shared it.
Right.
You know,
sometimes people hear about your book and they go, well, you know, this is a shocking, salacious kind of writing. But mm-hmm. really, when you start to read it, it's so layered and it's so much more than that. Mm-hmm. And so when you're teaching your workshops, do you encourage people to, you know, go to those hard places?
I do. I think that's a real feature of my teaching. And I do always qualify it with, I don't know, an encouragement that my students listen to their wisest parts, by which I mean we are not always ready to write about hard things. You know, I think that it requires a certain amount of support in many cases. It requires that we have the resources to sort of handle whatever comes up when we write about them. It can be very intense, you know, but I do believe that writing, and particularly memoir writing, is really concerned primarily with facing difficult things, with talking about things that people generally tend to avoid. And that's something that we look to memoir for, right? Because it's a relief to talk about things that we don't talk about, although nobody wants to do it, right? So in some ways, I think it's the job of the memoirist to start that conversation and to be like, okay, I'll talk about it, you know? And in doing so, we sort of perform an example so that other people know it's possible, you know? And so with my students, I try to just give them lots of opportunities. I give a lot of writing prompts And I encourage them to really sort of push up against what they generally want to avoid, right? Mm-hmm. But also to respect the wisdom of their own psyches, you know? Like, if we start to feel detached or panicked, don't go there, you know? We don't, there's no need to sort of torment ourselves, but I do think that writing, all kinds of writing, and particularly memoir, require a lot of courage.
Mm-hmm. Finding out what scares you and then putting it down on mm-hmm. the page. Mm-hmm. Do you think that it's true that not all writers, but some great writers, they just have one story. They have one story and they keep writing it over and over mm-hmm. again.
Mm-hmm. I think that collectively, as a civilization, we really just have a few stories that we keep writing over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I think the Greeks sort of set those down. I'm sure that the stories were happening before that. They were just transmitted orally. And I do also think that on a more micro level, that each writer has, I wouldn't say that they have one story, but I'd say that they have a set of preoccupations, maybe a constellation of interests and questions and worries and obsessions, right? And we sort of circle those things for our whole careers. And when I started writing, let's say after I finished my first book, you know, it was about some really intense subject matter, and it was about sort of, it factored down to these themes of desire and shame and feminism and secrecy and being seen. And after I wrote that book, my interest in those themes did not go away. And I thought, oh, I can't be writing about the same things all of the time. And then I thought back to the writers that I love most and really sort of the body of work of any writer that I admire. And if I look at all of their books, they're doing the exact same thing, you know, like that's why I love them, because they share my preoccupations, you know, like Jeanette Winterson was a really formative mm-hmm. sort of influence on me. And if you go back and read her whole oeuvre, you know, she's writing about the same things over and over again. And then, you know, she came out with a memoir a few years ago. And when I read her memoir, I felt, oh, here it is. Like, this is like so many of the stories from her life really led to the themes that she was tangling with in all of her novels and essays. And I think that's what we're meant to be doing, right? There aren't that many questions. There are some basic things that we'll never solve. And we look to writers to help us sort of explore them, if not answer them.
Thank you so much, Melissa, for joining us here on Book Lovers Cafe today. We look forward to seeing you at Centrum this year and into the future. I think you have, as we know now, a second home in Fort Townsend.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Join me next time, audience, to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to past shows and other programs on the podcast page on the website at kptz.org. You can make a donation to the station there as well. Thanks for helping with this program, all the volunteers and supporters. And the music you heard today was Billie Holiday. Join me next time. Bye.